Educational Rituals, Questioning How We Educate Our Children, by Steve Trowbridge. It has happened again. The teacher has walked to the front of the class and announced that you are going to read the next section of the textbook aloud. She starts with the first person in your row. Luckily, you sit near the back in a large class. The first person stands up for her turn in the torture chamber, and you begin to count the paragraphs, looking for the one that will be yours. Darn, there was a really short one in there. I wonder if she'll count that as one paragraph, or will she throw it into the one above it? I guess I'll have to practice two of them to be sure. You quickly start to go over your two paragraphs and feel fairly ready when the teacher calls on you. Turns out she counted the short one as a paragraph and you practiced the second one for nothing. Your palms sweat and your voice quavers as you stand and deliver your little recitation. Phew, that's over with. Now you can lean back and look out the windows or make fun of the other kids as they face the music. Your time to read and listen is over. Life is good. How many of us can recall just such a situation in our school careers? Be honest now. Among educators, this little exercise is called reading down the rows. Many of us had a similar experience when we moved to the reading circles. You remember those? Almost always three circles. The teacher went to great pains, sometimes, to try to ease our suffering by disguising the nature of the circles with clever names, bluebirds, redbirds, and robins, but we always knew them as the dumb kids, the average kids, and the smart kids. No fooling children. How many of us intellectually dropped out during these periods of public humiliation? How many of us began to think of ourselves as stupid, slow, dumb, or whatever name we could come up with? Why did teachers do it? Why are they still doing it? These are good questions that lead to many other good questions about our education system. The reasons for reading down the rows seem to be varied, or at least I have heard several explanations when I have discussed the practice with the teachers I work with every semester. I want to hear the students read so that I can assess their fluency and plan lessons for them. Or, if they don't read the assignments out loud, they just won't read them at all. Or, oral reading is a valuable skill for people during school and after they graduate. Let's look at the first one. I want to hear the students read so that I can assess their fluency and plan lessons for them. As a reader, would you read the same way in front of an audience, especially one made up of your peers, as you would in front of a single person who you knew wanted you to do well? If you want to assess my fluency, then place me in a situation where I can orally reproduce print and not have to pay for my miscues with a piece of my social flesh. If I am a marginal oral reproducer, I won't call this reading, as no comprehension is required. You force me either to become the fool or to act the fool. If given this choice, I'll act the fool every time. Then I can be the class clown. That is a safe and socially acceptable place to be. If you want to hear me read, do it with me alone. I trust you not to laugh, at least not too hard. Now think about the second one. If they don't read the assignments out loud, they just won't read them at all. To consider this one, go back and look at the scene that opened this article. Count the paragraphs, practice mine, lay back and relax. Kids aren't listening, or at least I wasn't. and I have a hunch I was not alone. How about the third one? Oral reading is a valuable skill for people during school and after they graduate. Now, this is a true statement. No question about it. The question is, does reading down the rows get this done? Do you become a good public speaker doing unpracticed recitations in an environment that can cost you your reputation and social standing? You decide on this one. Why would teachers still practice rituals that they know from personal experience had nothing but negative impacts on themselves and their friends? Well, that is a tough question, and one that leads, as I mentioned earlier, to other questions about our education system. I think the key term here is rituals. How many parts of our education system are in place because they are rituals that really have nothing to do with education or have a negative effect on education? Let's think about this for a minute. The dictionary defines a ritual as something that is ceremonial, prescribed by custom. What are some things in schools and our education system that are prescribed by custom? 1. Grades for assessment and grading systems. 2. Grade levels based on age. And 3. Learning based on a prescribed time schedule. Looking at the first ritual is interesting. Why do we give letter and number grades to our children as a reflection of their learning? Can anyone ferret out the piece of knowledge that is missing between a student who receives a 69% and a student who receives a 70%? We know that one gets an F and one gets a D, however. Has this always been the case? No. The 100-point scale did not rear its head until 1837, when mathematics and philosophy professors at Harvard began using it. In 1877, again at Harvard, professors began to look at how this 100-point scale might be divided up into easier-to-use chunks. The Harvard faculty records of 2 April 1877 specified, quote, "Students shall be ranked in each study in divisions according to merit. Division 1, 90 or more on a scale of 100. Division 2, 89 to 75. Division 3, 74 to 60. Division 4, 59 to 50. Division 5, 49 to 40. Division 6, below 40, end quote. In 1883, also at Harvard, the first letter grade, it was a B, by the way, was recorded. Apparently, Harvard was a hotbed of innovation, grade-wise, in the 19th century. So, number and letter grades did not even originate until the mid to late 19th century and did not take hold until much later. Quote, "Eventually, most educational institutions switched from numerical to letter grades, which represented groups of percentages during the 1930s and 1940s, end quote. If this is true, what did folks do before that? Oddly, they met with students as individuals or in small groups to assess whether the students had mastered whatever the instructor was teaching. It was a sort of show me process to product assessment. If an instructor wants to know if you can apply a mathematical concept, he or she can test you on the process or can set a meaningful task for you that depends on the process for its successful completion. The second choice is certainly time-consuming, but the instructor can coach you if you are on the wrong track so that eventually you master the task. No failure here. You keep working until you get it and then move on to the next step. However, this approach means that schools can't lump learners into easily manageable groups that move through the system together, which leads us to a discussion of our second and third rituals. Grade levels based on age, learning based on a schedule. One of the educational rituals that we have all experienced is being placed in a certain grade. You can usually estimate a child's age by taking his or her grade level and adding 5 years, when kids normally are allowed to start school. So a third grader is usually 8 to 9 years old, depending on the semester. This makes a certain amount of sense, since we know that, at least socially, most children are similar at certain ages. The question is, are they similar enough? In other words, do they know the same stuff to the same degree? That is really the important question, isn't it? When you were in school, I know that you were often in classes with children who were bored because the teacher moved too slowly, and with children who were lost because for them things were going too fast. If we as students knew this, didn't the teachers know too? As a teacher, I can tell you, they knew. The question becomes, if age-based grade levels are not a good way to group kids, then what is? A more basic question might be, why do we feel compelled to group kids at all? The next ritual deals with times and schedules. Why do we as learners move from place to place on a schedule rather than when we have mastered a topic? Is 45 minutes too long? Is 30 minutes too short? Is an hour, because it is easy to remember, just right? Both of these rituals stem in part from the time when public education began to flourish in the United States. In the mid-19th century, industry on a large scale had begun to grow. Educators began to see the factory system as a viable model for schools. Quote, "The common school created by Horace Mann, in which all children could learn to read, write, and use numbers, was developed for the purpose of saving the soul and working in the factories. Compliance and conformity were primary goals of these school programs. This gave rise to the public education system as we know it today, highly formalized, hierarchical structure designed to sort students who are eligible for promotion to a higher level in the system from those who are not." End quote. The connections between education and the factory system remain strong today and have been remarked upon frequently. Here is one author's description, which I find more than a bit frightening. Quote, "Our schools are currently more or less organized as an assembly line, running at a set speed, and with each worker or teacher at designated places or grade levels on the assembly line performing predetermined actions on products or students considered to be somewhat generic, one size fits all, and passive, waiting to be filled or formed to the desired shape." End quote. It is this idea of the assembly line that supports our present system of grade levels and set time frames for learning. I think we would all say that these practices don't make a lot of educational sense. Well, most of us would. But they have become so ingrained in our consciousness that it is almost impossible to form ideas of other ways of educating our children. I often point out the assembly line notion to my soon-to-be teachers and ask, "What else might we do instead?" They look like deer in the headlights. The best they can usually come up with is to continue with what we are already doing, but try to fine-tune it. There are so many other rituals that we have in schools that could be considered counterproductive for students. Here are just a few. 1. Everyone learns to read or to do math, science, whatever, in the same way. There are now many programs that have been instituted in schools that treat all children the same, even though we know that learners learn differently. Some learn best through their eyes, some through their ears, and some must touch things to truly understand them. yet we send in a single program. Odd, isn't it? 2, homework. This is an interesting one. We give homework for practice. If kids already understand the material, why are they practicing it? If they don't, why would we want them to practice doing it wrong? Shouldn't this work be done under the knowledgeable eye of the education professional, the teacher, we have placed in charge of their learning? 3, fluency practice without any connection to comprehension. Children are asked to read text aloud for speed and accuracy, but they do not have to be able to discuss the material afterward. I know the argument is that kids who can do this can spend more time on comprehension later, but in the meantime, doesn't it teach kids that reading is about speed and accuracy and not about understanding? It sends a false message and becomes just another ritual we do without thinking it through. There are many, many more, but you get the point. We, as folks who send our children to schools, work in schools, and hire young people who go through schools, need to ask, are the things we do in schools good for kids? If they are not good for kids, then perhaps we need to rethink how we organize schools as places of learning. Lest anyone think that I am coming down on teachers rather than on the system in which they work, let me say no. The teachers I have known work as hard as any group in this country. The hours are long. Most take their work home every night and on weekends. The money is not that great. And often there is little in the way of social payback. Teachers are not as respected as they once were. Teachers teach because they love children and want to help. For the majority of them, teaching is a calling rather than a job. However, they, like all of us, are ensnared in the rituals that I have discussed. I know that some of these rituals seem sacred and hard to think about relinquishing. But couldn't we devise an education system that makes sense to learners and educators alike? Let me invite you to try a little exercise, either alone or with friends. Think of the situations in which you learned the most without being aware of the effort it took. Riding a bike, building a doghouse, working with plants, training your dog. Now think of our current school system. Does today's school look like a place where you could enjoy similar learning experiences? If not, what would it take to make it such a place? Ask those you know who are involved with educating the children in your area. Maybe we can begin to do away with rituals that are not particularly good for kids and turn schools into places that students will hurry to in the morning because wonderful things are happening there. Places where children actually understand why they are learning and where learning is a pleasure.